Welcome to Dialogue, a true crime conversation. I am your host, Rebecca Sebastian, and I'm thrilled to be back on another Wednesday, another new episode, and it's November now, which means it's a new series. It also means some other things in the world, but as I record this, those things have not happened yet. So we are not talking about them. We are talking about the new series on Dialogue, and I'm excited to tell you it's podcasters. That's right. For November, each week, you are going to get a completely small talk free conversation with some of your favorite podcasters and hopefully some new podcasters that you don't know yet. You don't know that you're going to love yet. That's my hope. So today we're kicking it off with an amazing journalist and podcaster. But before I introduce him to you, let me just give you a couple of updates and quick announcements. I don't know about you, but I've been super disappointed with all the canceled events this year, right? Just one after another. So CrimeCon, of course, was canceled. We didn't go to Orlando, but they have put together a virtual live streaming all day long immersive experience called House Arrest, and I will be there. They have figured out a way to incorporate Podcast Row into the virtual event, just like they always do. And this is going to be a place where you can actually interact with podcasters you know and love, be in a room, get digital virtual swag, like the whole thing. I am so excited to be there. I want to meet you guys. I want to watch all the presentations. It's Saturday, November 21st, and it's happening all day. And if you register with the code DIALOGUE20, that's DIALOGUE20, you can get 10% off your pass. Also, if you head over to my Instagram at DialoguePod, that's DIALOGUEPOD, enter into my contest, which will be posted by the time you hear this. I am giving away one ticket. That's an $89 live access pass, and it could be yours. You just have to follow, comment. The rules are all on Instagram, but go ahead and follow me because there is no reason for you to miss this event. You can win a ticket. You can get 10% off. I want to see you there. I will be there. Also, if you're looking ahead to 2021, like I am right now, and crossing your fingers for a healthy new year and for CrimeCon in Austin to happen, I have already booked my tickets. I am going to be there live and in person. If that event happens, I am there. You can also use that same code, DIALOGUE20, for 10% off your Austin ticket. Okay, so DIALOGUE20 is what you need to remember to get savings on all your CrimeCon purchases. I will link to this announcement and to this show events in the show notes. So please check there for more information, as well as my Instagram feed that's on there too. But go ahead and check all of that out because I really am excited to interact with you guys and get our mind off other things. Am I right? Okay, so back to the November series of podcasters. Today, I am so excited to be speaking with Josh Dean. Now, some of you might know him from his work on the acclaimed hit podcast, The Clearing. That was just, I think, kind of a genre-busting true crime podcast, and we talk at length about The Clearing. But Josh came on because he's working on a new show, and the new show is called Chameleon, Hollywood Con Queen, and it's under the white collar crime category, which I'm a huge fan of because sometimes we just need to cleanse our palate from murder, right? So this is a really, oh God, it's such a cat and mouse, super fun whodunit. Also, why done it? Like, what are they doing and why? And at the time we recorded, only 3 episodes of Chameleon were out, but now 6 are out. So if you haven't started listening, now is a great time. You could go right now and listen and then come back and hear Josh, or you could hear me and Josh talk and then go back. We don't do any major spoilers. We just talk about the kind of the premise. And the really cool thing about Chameleon is they're crowdsourcing. They're asking listeners, do you know anything? They have a tip line. Call them, tell them, give them information. So you can get in on this story and get hooked like I am, because people want to know who is the Hollywood con queen. And according to Josh, sounds like we're going to find out. There will be a satisfying ending, but we don't know what that is yet. Also, he is kicking off our podcaster series for a couple of reasons, one of which we end up talking about cults, okay? I can't help it. It just comes up. I didn't even mean for it to come up, but it did. There is a con person cult leader connection and we made it. So it happened. I apologize in advance if anyone's tired of hearing me talk about cults. I will say Josh brought up NXIVM before I did, okay? Wasn't me. Really interesting though, the fact that there is this cult and con man, con woman connection. And I just thought this is the perfect segue between our cult series and moving into the true crime podcaster series. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Josh Dean, host and producer of Chameleon Hollywood Con Queen. Let's kill the small talk. All right, Josh, thank you so much for being on Dialogue, a true crime conversation. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this was very exciting. I'm glad this worked out because The Clearing is a really special podcast, in my opinion, and I think of many others as well. So the fact that you're doing a new show and that I didn't know, I was just so happy to discover that. And sometimes I'm so immersed in my research for different guests and things that I'll miss a show, a new podcast. So I'm so glad I now know about The Chameleon. So I want to talk about both of those shows. But before I do, I'd like to hear your background as a journalist and kind of this shift towards these true crime stories, if that's what you set out to do originally or not. So tell us a little bit about your work leading up to these shows.
So I've been primarily a sort of long, I guess you'd say a long form magazine journalist for most of my career. I was a magazine editor early in my career. I worked at Men's Journal. I helped found the beloved but short-lived New York Times sports magazine, which is called Play.
Oh, cool.
But mostly I've been a features writer for the last, well, let's say 15 years. I've been freelance so long that I can't really remember exactly when it started, a long time. So writing long form magazine pieces, sort of deeply reported, complicated narratives. I've written two books. I'm on my third book at the moment. So like, I like to spend a lot of time reporting and writing, you know, specific projects and then moving on to the next one. Typically in the magazine world, that means juggling a number of stories at one time. And then there's often been like a book in the background.
Wow.
So I'm never doing one thing. And then about 3 years ago, I guess, yeah, it's been about 3 years ago now since I started on The Clearing Project, which was my first podcast. And I sort of knew as soon as I heard, I mean, I guess Serial was everybody's entry into the serialized narrative. And as soon as I heard one, I thought like, this is a cool thing I would like to do someday, which is, you know, audio is similar in some ways and different in a lot of other ways, but the core skill set of being the sort of journalist host, primary reporter is pretty similar. I've loved it. Now, I mean, we could talk about this, but yeah, obviously I did The Clearing and then I now have started a company with three other journalists and Chameleon is our first project.
So cool. So at what point when you started The Clearing, I read that you went in thinking you were actually going to write about this. And then when did that pivot happen when you're like, you know what, this might be better told in an audio format?
Yeah, so it was originally, it was supposed to be a New York Times Magazine story. And it was actually assigned as a piece. I mean, you know, for people who have heard the show, in episode 4, we meet this character named John Cameron, who was sort of like the lead Edwards conspiracy theorist who concocted this sort of like universe of Edwards murders, most of which I believe to not be true. Mm-hmm. So the original conception for the article was going to be kind of about him, how this, you know, retired detective got obsessed with one murderer and made him his bogeyman and, you know, kind of went wildly off the rails in the process. And in the course of reporting that, I was able to convince April to talk to me and she hadn't spoken to the media since she'd turned her dad in. And this will make more sense to people who've seen the show. I can explain a little bit.
Let's do a brief overview of the story. The daughter who outs her, she suspects her father of murder. And that's kind of where we start the story. But why don't you tell people the overview?
Okay. Yeah. So then I'll go back to that story. But
yeah, yeah.
So basically, yes. So The Clearing, yeah, it's the story of a woman named April Bellaccio who, in her, you know, middle-aged adulthood, she had grown kids, had always had a feeling that something was wrong about her dad. I mean, it was obvious to her that he was a criminal and that he was a con man and that he had been lying to them about things, but she suspected far darker things that he had perhaps, if not probably, killed someone or some number of people. And so she kind of got obsessed with the idea of looking into places that she had lived, and she found a double murder in Wisconsin that had occurred. And it just sort of like, you know, it was like a Proustian moment where she's like, oh my God, that's it. That's those kids. My dad killed those kids. And so she called a detective in Wisconsin and said, you know, I know this sounds crazy, but I think that was my dad, this unsolved murder from 30 years ago. And it turned out to be true. And he subsequently confessed to another double murderer, and then a murder of his adopted son. And then, you know, we suspect other murders, certainly not as many as this detective who kind of turned Edwards into a, you know, a boogeyman who could claim every unsolved murder in America. So basically,
there's a few of those. There's a few people like that that think one person is the Zodiac killer and the Black Dahlia killer and some other ones. But it's interesting.
So basically, to go back to the how it became a podcast. So I was writing about that detective and his obsession with Edward Wayne Edwards, who was April's father, and then in the course of that, I met April. Interviewed her in Ohio. We struck up friendship is probably fair, but all certainly like a correspondence. And I just realized that the way more interesting story was her story. And she was still on this quest to understand what her father had done. And I thought, as a journalist, it was a really interesting experiment. We were almost like reconstructing her past and trying to figure out what was true and what was not. Because everything she realized, so much of what she thought was a lie. You know, the reasons that the family kept moving weren't what her dad was telling them. It was because he had either killed someone or committed some crime in that town and had to leave. And so I was almost helping her reconstruct her biography and figure out what he had and hadn't done. And then, of course, we turned up all kinds of tape. Her dad, you know, from an audio perspective, her dad had recorded himself obsessively throughout his life, you know, largely mundane, just would like leave a tape recorder running and would record his phone calls and would just, we had tape of the day April was born when he was sitting in the waiting room at the hospital while his wife delivered April. And we didn't know that actually the podcast project began. We knew there was some tape, but there was a trove of tapes that April helped us stumble onto that really, you know, Edwards himself was deceased before we began the project. So it didn't mean we couldn't have done it anyway, because April was really the key to the project. But having his voice and being able to hear so much of his experience and his personality and his storytelling, you know, it really brought him to life as a character. And it was like, you know, in retrospect, I don't know how it could have been anything but a podcast, but it did actually start as a magazine story.
It was a happy accident that you came across that. And, you know, I have to say, I just think April is so remarkable. And I have to think that there'd be so much in your subconscious because of trauma that she'd buried and memories, and there'd have to be something in your mind telling you like not to believe that and not to follow that thread, right? I think so many people would be very scared to go close to that and not only thinking it, but then articulating it and then acting on it, right? It was really just so brave to me that she felt that conviction so deeply that she had to do something about it. And you just get to know her so much over the course of the story that that's who she is. It's remarkable.
And I've never, you know, worked with a subject so closely. It was a different and often complicated experience for me as a journalist, because you're supposed to be very detached from your subject. And the clearing is very much a partnership. You know, I'm like helping her. I'm the professional journalist and storyteller, but it's really her story, and we're trying to unearth her memories. And you're right. I mean, you know, we talk about this a lot on the show, where she's like, this is what I remember, but I don't know if these memories are to be believed or not. Like, are they actual memories, or are they just the way that I want to remember things? Or are they like the skewed picture that my dad had painted for us? And so, yeah, I mean, I can't put myself in her shoes and what it would be like to, you know, one, to be living with that. Obviously, as we unearth more and more of her story, I mean, she had a, you know, tragic childhood of like, you know, constantly being uprooted, and her father was abusive, and, you know, her mother was abused, and, you know, they didn't have money, and they were living in like terrible circumstances at times. And, you know, and she turned out to be a very well-adjusted mother of three, and you know, somehow got through it all. And then not only that, but like then had this really terrible black cloud over her all along, thinking like, there's some part of this I don't really understand yet. And let's say, even if you were certain that it was true, it takes a lot of bravery to make that phone call. It's certainly easier to go on with your life not knowing that your father was a serial killer than it is to find out that he was. And then not only that, but to continue pursuing that thread and wanting to know, you know, she wants to know if he's responsible for more murders that she would like to help those families find out that, you know, this is the truth they've been seeking, you know, because I think we could talk about this, but we, you know, we were very important for us in the series to deal with victims and the, you know, what a unsolved murder does to a family, and that it's a different kind of grief and trauma that you live with. And even decades later, it haunts people. And I think she just feels, I feel bad for her in a way, because it's almost like an itch she can't scratch, because I don't know that any amount of proving that he did things will ever convince her that she's done, that he, yeah. You know.
Well, that's how she sounds at the end, that she still, she wishes she could have the sort of resolution she experiences with the one family in Wisconsin with more families and surviving members of the victims. And that says a lot about her, but she's definitely carrying that, you know, that's like something she's taking on as her own, you know, and maybe to varying degrees. And I don't know where she's at with that now, but the podcast is so interesting to me because, you know, a victim forward perspective we're seeing, we see that in true crime more and more, which I'm glad we see murder investigations, or we see something from the family members or friends of survivors of a victim. But it felt like we were kind of seeing three things in the clearing. We were kind of going through it with the family member survivor of the perpetrator and the victim family. And there's a murder investigation element too, because you're discovering and uncovering. So it was this trifecta of true crime experience, which I think is maybe what people got super excited about. It felt really different and new. How did you see that? And were you at all thinking of the true crime genre and where this fits in? Or were you just following the story? Or were you slanting it for a certain audience?
No, I mean, all of that is true. I mean, Jonathan Menjivar, the producer, and myself, you know, and podcasts are like, especially a podcast like this is such a collaboration between April and myself, obviously, but the producer, Jonathan, was there right along the, every step of the way. And he and I talked a lot about this, which was, you know, we are uncomfortable to some degree with a lot of the true crime. I do think you're right. It's getting better. And I think there's more of an effort now to be sensitive to the victims' families and to the victims' memories. And I think, you know, we're seeing more ambitious, more interesting takes. But we were very conscious of that because we started this 3 years ago, pretty early in the, I mean, sure, there were a lot of true crime shows out, but it was still fairly early in the boom. Yeah. And we, and I think some of the early ones we, you know, we were feeling like this is a really heavy subject matter. We want to make sure we do this, you know, in the most responsible way possible, but maybe we can also make it like a bit of a commentary on the genre, because we actually, you know, we had April, obviously. So people often ask me, you know, what are you comfortable telling? Like what kind of murder stories in particular are ethically fraught, right? Morally fraught. Like it's difficult to justify in some cases why you're doing this. You don't want to make a hero out of a murderer. You don't want to dredge up somebody's worst memories unnecessarily. And I felt like with April, we had a real reason for doing it. I wasn't just doing it because I thought Edward Wayne Edwards was an interesting guy, even though I did find him to be an interesting guy. April was the driving force of the podcast. She wanted to do it. So like every day I could say like, I'm not doing this because I want to tell a murderer story. I'm doing this because the daughter of that murderer feels compelled to figure out what's true and what wasn't. But at the same time, we had this detective character who had turned Edwards into like that kind of like almost fictionalized character for entertainment's sake. I don't think he was doing it to make a hero out of it. And I think he just lost his way and got like so obsessed and fell into a rabbit hole and was no longer able to discern what was true from what wasn't. But as a result, Edwards became kind of almost like a meme. You know, it was like people were like saying he did all these things and it was almost like a game to try and figure out. So there was a way in which you could have told his story that would have felt really gross. But we thought like, okay, we can help April figure out the truth and we can sort of take on this character directly. And it was always in the plans to make John Cameron part of the show, which was like, let's go and see him with April and talk to him about like, you know, why are you telling this version of a story? And why do you feel like it's okay? And because, you know, it's a different kind of torture to people. You know, let's say your child or your husband or your wife or your sister was murdered by someone and it's an unsolved crime. And then someone shows up and says, I know who did it. Well, but that guy didn't actually do it. So now you spend some amount of time thinking that, oh, this was the killer. And maybe you feel better. Maybe you feel worse. But, you know, only the slightest bit of digging would prove that that's not the case. That person didn't do it. So now all you've done is either given them false hope or false pain or something. So we felt like, in that sense, it was a bit of a meta narrative of true crime where we could sort of talk about the damage that's done in the, like, media sense.
Yeah.
Also look at how it impacts victims from a few different perspectives. Because April is a victim, too. Like, her siblings are, and her mom is, and so, yeah, I mean, that was a long and complicated answer, but you're right. We were thinking on all those levels, and I think, you know, the show wasn't started to be a commentary, but I think there are elements of it that were like embracing or taking on the idea that you have to be careful what you're doing here.
Definitely. And you know, one of the questions I often ask my guests, and I know I gave you in advance, is, you know, can you be a critic and consumer of this genre? And I think you basically just answered that yes. And it sounds like the way you shaped your work and the way you were thinking and intentional about it is your response to maybe what you aren't as happy in seeing happen in that genre. And I know for me, I'm just excited to see the genre expand to include different elements and different points of view. And one of those is the family members of perpetrators, because they are victims, like you said. And I think it's an underreported perspective. And it's a tougher story to tell. I think when we find out someone did something, we're really kind of ready to just trash them and everything around them, including, you know, sometimes the very unwitting family members. I think it's hard for people to believe that you couldn't know or something. But of course, how could a child be, even if they did know somewhere deep in their bones, how could they be in any way responsible, you know, or to blame, or they're completely victims. So love how you're thinking about it and how you approached it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, so it was easy for us to, you know, April was such a part of the show, and you know, she doesn't see it from that way. She wouldn't. In fact, she bristles when you talk to her about being a victim, or, you know, like a lot of people, you know, talk about how brave she is and how heroic it is. And I, you know, agree with those sentiments. And she gets really uncomfortable hearing that, because she doesn't feel like, you know, I didn't do anything special. I just did the right thing, you know, and which is not to say that her siblings who didn't do that did the wrong thing.
Because,
like, I mean, first of all, who knew what was true? And also, everybody lives with their own demons. And, you know, I would never criticize anyone in a family of a terrible criminal for not doing enough to stop that person. Certainly not a child. In a lot of cases, not even a, you know, a spouse who's been abused or like psychologically damaged or, you know, gaslit for decades, you know.
Yeah, there's so much at play there that you really can't speak into how or what you might do in that scenario. And everyone's thresholds are different, like you're saying, but her response just sounds like such nice, good, sort of humble Midwestern lack of pride and ego, which is so refreshing and lovely. So that's the clearing. And then now we are in the middle of, or I don't know if we're quite at the middle point, but The Chameleon came out, your next podcast. So you've done the clearing, and now did your audio company, your production company, happen with the clearing or after that you started?
So after.
Okay.
You know, I enjoyed the clearing experience so much. And we worked on it a long time. It was more than 2 years, I think, that Jonathan and I were working on it. And April and I had been talking for a year before I even began that. So I made the clearing with Pineapple Street, and then Gimlet partnered as a marketing and distribution partner. And I really liked it. And I felt like at the end of it, I had a few friends, Matt Scher, who made Over My Dead Body for Wondery, and Vanessa Grigoriadis, who's like a very well-known narrative magazine writer who made a show called Tabloid for Luminary. The three of us were just talking about, you know, how with this specific kind of show, with a serialized narrative, like deeply reported, ambitious, expensive, like complicated stories to tell, like the narrative magazine journalist slash book author, it's almost always the host of those shows, because it's a very close overlap in skill set. And of course you need amazing audio producers to make it sound good, and in a lot of ways you need them to, you know, if it's someone who has never worked in audio before, to like retrain people in asking questions for audio, for instance, so that they say things in full sentences or answer you in a way that makes sense, because you can't write around it the way that we always have been able to do in print. And so the three of us just got talking about that and said, well, what if we started a a company that was just built around this genre. We will only make serialized narrative shows with prominent journalists as the hosts and key reporters. And it happened pretty quickly. We came up with the idea last summer, and we had founded the company by fall. We had investors by the end of the year. And we were, Vanessa, who's sort of co-show running and writing Chameleon with me, she and I started working on it in October of last year. So it's been a year now.
Okay.
And even before, our company is called Campside Media. Even before Campside had been announced, because we didn't announce ourselves until March, we kind of existed in the winter. And she and I, we bootstrapped the show for a while. And then once we had investment in the company, we were able to like throw more resources at it. And so we've been working on it for about a year. And yeah, Chameleon is Campside's first project.
Well, congratulations on Campside officially launching March. That's a tough month to do anything in the world. So
tell me about it.
You know, now we know we might have missed it. Things were going on in the world. But so Chameleon, let's talk about that, because talk about expanding the genre. I'm loving all the white collar scam, fraud, and by love I mean enjoy consuming stories that are coming out. I think there's some really great podcasts around this topic. And yours, instead of featuring a different one every week, like you said, you're focusing on serialized stories. So let's talk about Chameleon. How in the world you found this story? Now, this podcast, just for listeners, is out now, and we're 3 episodes in as of this recording. Yeah. And so how many will there be? And then let's go to the beginning.
So we think it'll be 10 parts, maybe 12.
Ooh.
There'll be some bonuses. And yeah, it, depending on what happens late in the season, there could be a few more.
Right. So, okay, cool.
So yeah, Chameleon is the story of the so-called Hollywood con queen. And this is a scam that has gone on for at least 5 years, and we think possibly longer. And basically, someone or some group of people has been impersonating very powerful Hollywood women, so studio chiefs and producers and high profile directors. It's always women, and like quote unquote hiring kind of lower level gig workers, so makeup artists and security guards, stuntmen, mostly men but not always men, and later as the scam evolved, photographers and some travel writers. And basically the idea is that there's always this movie, a big budget movie in Indonesia. So 20 hours around the world. And, you know, you would think, oh my God, how would anyone fall for that? Well, we know hundreds of people have fallen into the trap, and we think it may be over 1,000 people at this point. So basically they have all done the exact same thing. The movie isn't always the same. The woman on the phone isn't always the same and moves around. And sort of the target group, it moves from like makeup artists to bit part actors to security guards. It sort of evolves over time and maybe comes back and forth. And all of these people have chosen to pay their own way to fly to Jakarta, Indonesia, and they get there and they realize there's no movie. And they end up paying out money in like relatively small sums, like hundreds to maybe a few thousand, and like, you know, fees you know, permits and like admittances to places, but very small amounts of money, which is one of the most puzzling parts of the scam, because everyone always, you know, every time I tell someone the story, they're like, well, that's a lot of work to get like a few thousand bucks out of somebody. I mean, the logistics involved are unbelievable. And that's all true. I mean, yes, over time, we think the culprits have gotten well over $1 million, but still the amount of work that's gone into getting that $1 million,
like they almost earned it at that point.
I mean, there are like, you know, dozens of people on a weekly basis, I feel like, defrauding companies and making more money than that.
Yeah.
And so it's a fascinating psychological scam. I think it's a lot about control and manipulation. And there's some creepier stuff that happens later in the season. So we're in episode 3 now, just starting to get into like some of the most exciting twists. I don't want to give too much away now.
I know.
We're about to learn some exciting things.
Oh, good. Because, you know, I mean, I'm hooked without knowing those. So I'm definitely here for it. I can't wait to find out what happens. But I mean, let's talk about it a little bit in terms of, you know, the profile of the people that are being targeted, right? So as you mentioned, these are people in the entertainment industry. They are working, but they are freelancers. And so they're not, some of them seem to have representation. I mean, it isn't like they're plucked out of nowhere, but they may be, I don't know, when you say how could people have fallen for it, it doesn't sound completely crazy to me because, you know, they're hungry, they're hustling. You never know how these things come together. These deals kind of do materialize quickly and dissolve. So you grab it. You want me on the plane to Indonesia, I'll go. And as a freelancer, even you and your co-host said, it's not unusual to charge that on your own and then get reimbursed.
Not at all. I mean, I've been living like that for, like I said at the beginning, I've been a freelancer for, I can't even remember how long, like 15 years now. And all the time I've paid my own. And, you know, you just assume in good faith, and often you have a relationship with the person, like, you know, magazine editors, for instance, I typically know them. So I trust that they're not lying to me, but not in every case. There certainly have been cases where I've taken work from someone who I've never met in person.
Right.
But only, maybe I talked to on the phone, but via emails. And, you know, we say on the show, it's kind of the perfect scam for our age because you don't meet people. And I mean, actually the pandemic's changed it a little bit because we talk like this on Zoom. Before COVID, I didn't talk to people on Zoom. I talked to you on the phone. I would email people.
Yeah.
A lot of our relationships are virtual. They're through social media and direct messages. So this is like the perfect scam. It targets a level of person who's successful to a point, but like just starting to get going. So like the kind of perfect moment to target ambition, which is like on the verge of making it and just looking for the big break. In Hollywood, I mean, this is the dream in Hollywood, is that like if you work hard enough and you just bang on enough doors, one day somebody is going to offer you the job of a lifetime. I mean, that's just the story Hollywood's been selling. And this is a scammer who basically weaponize that and targets those people at that moment in their career and says like, hey, I know you're like a junior makeup assistant. Like, how would you like to run a makeup department? There's this huge movie and we want to give you your chance. And all you have to do is get on a plane. And I was talking, it's the crazy thing about it is it's still going on. This, you know, con artist is still at large. And I was talking to someone 2 days ago, who's a fairly, you know, I'm not going to say like an accomplished actor and that works regularly and like gets work, is, you know, has a decent career going, is not a star, but like, you know, by most metrics would be considered successful. And he fell for it recently. And he just said, like, I even called my agent and my agent said, it's not impossible. It could happen. And in that case, he was hearing from, you know, what he thought was an established director who was a little bit older. And the agent was like, oh, maybe that's just how he does things. Like,
yeah.
So even the reps in some cases, and I think in a lot of cases, a rep would be like, no, don't pay your own way. But I talked to now dozens of people and almost of them said, when I talked to my friends, they said, sounds a little weird, but like, what if it's true? Because if it's true and you say no, you're going to regret it for the rest of your life. So even if it's like 95% of your brain is saying scam, the 5% that says, if this is real, I'm going to be like the main makeup artist on $100 million movie, my career will be made. Like my life will change. So I think the thing is, we all want to believe that the outcome for us is going to be the good one, right? We don't, you don't want to think like, because you got to remember the other part of, and we will grab, as the series go on, we're going to grapple a lot with shame and why. And similarly to what you were saying about the clearing, I mean, this show will also talk about scams in general and con artists and why we are so susceptible as humans. And even, you know, this perception that, you know, only naive people or old people fall for it. Well, that's just not true. And we all want to be better and more successful. And the other part of the scam is that the shame is a weapon, because when you get scammed, you don't want to tell people about it. You don't come back. I mean, imagine this happens to you and you come back, you've just paid your way to Jakarta. You realize it was a lie and you come back. Like, you don't want to tell anybody that story.
Right.
Like, maybe your spouse, but like, you don't want to tell even, I guess you tell your agent, but like, because in your mind, you're like, I'm dumb. I'm a loser. I'm like so embarrassed. Like, and on top of that, the worst part, and I think this is where I really feel bad for people, it's like, maybe I'm not good enough. Like, like this is all, it's, you know, I'm the kind of person who gets scammed. I'm not the kind of person who succeeds. And we've seen people who've quit the business because of it. Sadly, I mean, well, fortunately, most people have not, but there were some people who quit and were just so crushed by it. And it's a real, you know, it's a psychological game that I think con artists enjoy, that part of it, the control and the shame and the, And it's why it's a little bit darker than just almost every victim said to me, like, sometimes I tell the story and people are just like, oh, you're so dumb. How could you fall for that? Like, you know.
That reduces it to something that isn't quite right for all the reasons you stated. I think there's something much darker going on because people are targeting people in the way, you know, who fit the profile of what you described. And it's interesting, as I hear you talk, I'm in the middle of my series on cults, and there's a weird dynamic and overlap to the way cult leaders target people at a vulnerable, it's like the perfect storm. And for cults, I mean, people respond the same way. How could you have fallen for that? I never would have said yes. But people aren't saying, hi, come join my cult. They're inviting you to something that's appealing specifically to you, and they know that. And usually you've had some kind of life change in the time frame to make yourself open to that opportunity. And it sounds just kind of like this scam. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you're right. I mean, I've heard people, now that talking about Nexium, you know, Vanessa, my co-host on this show, I think she may have gotten the last interview with Keith. She's written about Nexium
quite a bit.
And cults. And yeah, I mean, I like a lot of people who watched that show, because of the way they chose to make the vow, which it's gotten some criticism. People say it's slow. I actually think it's really well done.
And I do too.
Like, it really shows how you can get into it. And I've heard multiple people say, like, I definitely could have seen myself going to one of those seminars. And like, it builds you up. It makes you feel better about yourself. And in that case, you know, hearing about it years later, we're like, oh, you paid $5,000 to go to some stupid seminar. Well, I mean, that's not how they're selling it to you, right?
Exactly.
In this case, it's sort of like, oh my God, you paid $2,000 to fly yourself to Indonesia. Well, remember, at the time, you're doing that because you think when you get there, you're going to get this amazing job. So who cares about $2,000? Like, they're going to pay me back. And even if they don't, my life is changing. From this moment on, everything is amazing, right?
Yeah.
We only, in retrospect, we tend to fixate on the, like, how could you have done that? That was so stupid. Or how did you not see it? Well, none of these things would work if that's how they, like, pitch themselves to the world. And you're right. Every cult has some charismatic leader who's able to target a certain type of person who, we all have our insecurities and want to be better. And, you know, there's that one, I mean, this is what salesmen do, right, too, right? Like, every TV pitch, like, and like radio ad, and they're like trying to appeal to that part of you that's like, oh yeah, I could be smarter. I could sleep better. I should know French, you know. It's just like, whatever it is, you're like, none of us are so confident. And there's one character in Chameleon who comes in episode, where is he? He's late in the season, as we realize that the scam keeps evolving, and the scam itself, like, just sort of like slowly changes in order to target a new person. And there's this quite famous chef. So we don't use his name. We even hired a voice actor to fill in for him, but I had to use him because I was like, here's a person who's successful by any metric. He runs restaurants, he's published books. Everybody probably wants to be him if you're an aspiring chef. And yet he got a phone call from, in this case, it wasn't a Hollywood, it was a female billionaire, Asian mogul. Because the guy sometimes will move out of Hollywood into like business moguls, but always women. And this guy was like, you know, I didn't say this to him, but I'm thinking like, well, you have nothing else to prove, man. Like, why would you take this flyer?
Right.
But he was actually one of the most deeply wounded victims I talked to, because he, I think, like, knew that he was successful, but yet still wanted more, was never happy and wanted more. And this really dinged his confidence, because he thought like, oh wait, maybe I'm not successful. Like, if I'm the kind of guy who could fall for this, like, maybe I'm not actually successful at all. And he went into some really dark places, and he concocted this whole, there's an incredible episode about like where he believed, like, he went into some serious conspiracy territory of what was happening here. And I think it was part of trying to justify how it had happened to him, because to just think that like someone out there was like using me like a marionette, pulling on strings, that's just not a place he was willing to go. He needed to think that he was part of some like massive conspiracy that was targeting all kinds of people. So there's a lot of that, like, as the show goes on, like looking at the psychology of why this happens to us and who it happens to and the damage that it's done. And I think, you know, like, cause even now I still hear people who've listened to the first two episodes and really like it, but they're still like, okay. At the end of the day, they weren't really harmed.
Yeah.
And like, actually they were. I mean, I talked to a lot of these people and I've dealt with, you know, I've done crime stories and dealt with victims. They don't sound to me like people who weren't traumatized.
Yep.
Thank you for supporting Crawl Space Media Podcasts. I am here to tell you about LA Not So Confidential, the forensic psychology and true crime podcast brought to you by me, Dr. Shiloh, and this guy.
Hey, I'm her bestie and co-host, Dr. Scott. She was a cop and I was a Hollywood casting director. Now we're both forensic psychologists working in Los Angeles. Twice a month, we bring you a classic or contemporary true crime story. We apply the real psychological concepts behind the story and dish on the media's representations of those cases.
Subscribe now to LA
Not So
Confidential, wherever you get your Crawl Space Media podcasts. True crime, psychology, and snark.
Trust us, we're doctors.
My gosh, so much that you're saying I want to respond to. The last with the chef, of course, you know, everyone's going to be listening, wondering if they can piece together who that chef is, because the true crime audience is a sleuthy bunch. So they're going to be listening. But I'm thinking also the benefit of hindsight, right? So when we watch The Vow and when we're going to listen to Chameleon, we know that it's a scam. So we're listening like, well, duh. And we know Keith Raniere is now awaiting sentencing in Brooklyn Federal Prison. So we get that benefit. And if we could just kind of remove that, it might help empathize with the people involved and the victims a bit more. So that's kind of unfair, right? That we have that advantage.
And I think con artist has to be one of the oldest like business professions. Like there have been con artists as long as there have been humans.
Sure. They're
probably like caveman con artists.
Totally.
It's just like, because we are just going, we're never going to stop being susceptible to it, because it just, it's like a perfectly engineered crime to target human vulnerabilities. And I think, you know, it's just, you see in a scam like the Con Queen scam, it's just like fairly well exposed at this point. You would think if you worked in Hollywood, there's no way you would ever fall for this. And yet it's still working 5, maybe 6 years later, just because every alarm bell could be going off, but you just want to believe. We all want to believe.
Right, right. And, you know, to your point about the chef going into conspiracy thinking mode, theorizing, I just interviewed a cult expert and we talked about conspiracy theorists and the desire there, the underlying kind of universal thread is that people don't like the gray. They don't want to believe what you were talking about, this, that they were just targeted and plucked. There must be something bigger. And so they want things to be black and white and they want answers to what really there might not be an answer for. And like, trouble with reconciling mystery and just the unknown. So that's something that I think a lot of us feel too, as a desire for answers and absolutes.
You're going to hear a lot of that as Chameleon goes on. I would say like almost every episode has some new person, like every conversation I had with a victim or an investigator or something, that everybody's just like, I don't get it. Like what is the reason that this thing exists? And I think there may not be a good answer to that. So then, yeah, then you look for an answer, because you don't want to think like, I was like, lost all this money and I was traumatized and I went on this journey and there's no reason for it. It's like, it just doesn't make sense. And I think sometimes you have to understand that it won't make sense. It just means some criminal or some group of criminals out there, like probably and almost certainly, and you see this with cults certainly, there's always, money is a factor, but there's always a psychological reason. It's about control and manipulation. And, and the cult leader and leaders tend to be getting a rush out of the fact that they are just controlling people, you know? And I think certainly in the Con Queen scam, I'm convinced that, you know, when we know who's behind it and the true story of that person or people, it's going to come down, a lot of it is going to be about control and psychological domination. And, you know, probably the perpetrators have their own damage that caused them to become this villain who I would suspect even in their own mind, and probably cult leaders too, are able to justify it in the same way the victims are, where they think, like, they're not thinking, I love to control people and I'm just doing this to dominate. They don't think that. They think, oh, I'm helping these people. These were vulnerable. These were wounded people. They were sad people.
Totally.
They were unsuccessful people. And thanks to me, they're confident and they're successful. Obviously, in this case, that's not happening. I'm sure what this con artist is probably thinking is like, ah, who cares? Like, they flew to Jakarta. They lost a couple $1,000s. Like,
right. No harm, no foul.
Cry me a river. Like, what have I done?
Right. So as of episode 3, the working theory is that this is one woman. So you're saying chameleon, and the subtitle, right, is the tale of the Hollywood con queen.
Hollywood con queen, yep.
So still the working theory? Because you said people are person or people. So could this be one person? Because we're talking about someone impersonating different accents, males and females. You know, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, yes, we know it's one person. I think as the series goes on, you're going to learn a lot more about that person.
Oh my gosh.
As we learn more and more, it's an ongoing investigation, I should say.
Yeah.
Hunt, if you want to call it that. So I think also I should say the show has a bit of, I would say the first half of the series is a little bit more of like meeting the characters, unpacking the scam, because it's a complicated story and we had to sort of parcel out, like let you see how it works. It, like, this is what it looks like from the victim's perspective. And then this is how the scam kind of operates. And then as we slowly build toward like figuring out who it could be. And then in the second half of the series, it's a bit more of a like whodunit hunt.
Cool.
As we continue to pursue the person. Yes, but we're convinced, yeah, it's one mastermind. Which doesn't mean there aren't accomplices. And one of the things we said in, I think, episode 3, and we'll talk about some more, is that they're accomplices, and I think in most cases, fairly unwitting, or like they know they're up to something shady. But like, for instance, when you get to Jakarta, there's this driver who picks up almost all the victims. Like, there's no way that guy doesn't know that he's not in on something. Do I think he knows that he's in on this massive 5-year-long multi-million-dollar? I don't know that that's the case. Maybe like cops have come and talked to him by this point. I'm sure that has happened. But I don't think he's like in the room doing the plotting. And similarly, there's like money changers and clearly someone is transmitting the money back to the scammer.
Yeah.
And then the scammer's also, you know, creatively brilliant. And I keep talking to Hollywood people who are like, you know, this person could have been like a great executive, because he's like, there's like the making up movies and creating these slick PDFs and like writing scripts. And like when I see the like, there's like notes for the set designers or the makeup, like someone is sitting down and actually like basically inventing movies and then like writing documents that are plausible enough to fool people who work in the industry.
Jeez.
And then creating these like bulletproof paper trails using incredible cybersecurity. So we have this digital investigations guy who comes on later in the season too.
Ooh,
he's been working with us from the beginning. And he says, I think it's in episode 7, like this person has better operational security than like, he's like, I've tracked like Russian mercenaries in the Ukraine. This person is better at hiding his or her tracks than like anyone I've ever dealt with before. So it's a real, you know, I hate to use the term genius, but like other people on the show throw it out, like genius level creative person, but also technical person. And then, yeah, you're saying like, can do multiple accents, can be men and women, can be Chinese, English, Australian, Californian, New York. And you can pick any one of those accents apart, but they fool people. They've all worked.
Sure.
I haven't heard, not one person has said to me, I didn't believe it was a British person, or I didn't believe it was an Australian person. So like, you know, I think by the end, everyone's going to want to know, well, who could be capable of this? What human out there? And I feel increasingly confident that we will be able to paint that picture. I can't say.
Oh my gosh. This is so interesting. Okay. So two things about the con person specifically that you said. First, like, what a bummer. You know, whenever I see someone who's brilliant, you know, using their talent for destruction and chaos and crime, just really bums me out, for lack of a better word. I just think of wasted talent, and Charles Manson comes to mind because he was actually a very talented musician. He has a version, the Beach Boys bought one of his songs, and his Charlie Manson's version is so much better than the Beach Boys like cleaned up version. But I digress. My point is, like, was he just a frustrated artist? And anyway, so that's just such a waste of talent and cult leaders, you know, things like that. I always think, you know, it's like a Steve Jobs used it for good. I mean, he was tough to work for, but he didn't lead a cult. He just built Apple, you know? Second, could it be somebody who actually does work in the industry and is doing this on the side for like weird kicks?
Well, yeah, I think first of all, yeah, you're right. And I heard, actually, you know, it's an interesting parallel with mentioning Manson. Like, I would hear this from April, and I would hear this from cops too, and like reporting the clearing, which was like, if Edwards had applied himself to being a business person or a creative type, he could have been very successful. Again, very smart, very entrepreneurial. And I think that's sadly a trait you see with a lot of serial killers, is that because to do it, you have to be so devious and smart. And unfortunately, you know, so you're going to see that story repeat itself. I think with con artists, very similar. You can't be dumb. You can't be lazy. You can't make mistakes. You have to be fastidious, and you have to be, you know, chameleon. When we stumbled onto the term chameleon, it was the perfect name, because you have to be able to change who you are in a convincing fashion over and over and over again. And in the case of the con queen, what's amazing is that it's happening over the course of a day. There may be a British person, an American person. And so juggling phone calls and emails as these different personas. And I say a couple times in the show, like, the logistics to me are mind boggling. Like,
yeah,
there must just be like a huge spreadsheet on the wall of like, okay, this is who I am right now.
In this time zone.
For now.
Yeah.
And now I'm calling. Yeah. Now I'm calling Australia, and it's the morning. So I have to say good morning. And I'm now Chinese. Like, just crazy. Mind-boggling. And as for Hollywood, yeah, I mean, every time I talk to a Hollywood person about it, they're like, this has to be somebody who's pissed off at Hollywood, like either didn't make it and was close, or got washed out,
right?
Or, you know, because when I was talking about the psychological part, like, it does seem like there's some revenge being sought here, like this person is trying to damage an industry that did harm, you know. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if we find out that the perpetrator has some sort of like tortured history with the entertainment industry, that there's something happened a long time ago. Could it be an executive, like, you know, someone in the industry who's just, I mean, that'd be a hell of an ending, wouldn't it? To find out.
Oh my gosh. Then you're basically, you've got the, you can start writing the screenplay as soon as you find that out. Cause my gosh. Yeah. That's really interesting to think about, some vendetta against the industry. And, you know, it's almost this weird, not parody, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, of Hollywood, with the scripts that they talk about, the kung fu movie that you learn about in The Chameleon. Is parody the right word, or satire? It's
satire.
Like, yeah. It's like they're almost, it's wild. So I'm just so excited for the next several episodes. I think this is a really compelling, unique story. And I wanted to talk about, you know, you're kind of doing what you did with The Clearing, in that you're bringing another element of the true crime genre and community in by crowd solving, or at least it seems like you are, because you're actively asking for tips and leads. So I'm curious, has anything viable come in since releasing the first three episodes?
Not yet. Well, we're only 2 weeks in. So we did two episodes the first week, and then third episode yesterday. So we're still pretty early. Nothing viable yet. Although, like, victims continue to arrive. I wouldn't say the show itself, like the number of the email, but as what's happened a lot is, as people find out we're working on it, like, one victim will talk to another victim.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, I think one reason this perpetuated for so long is because of the shame, and people weren't sharing the stories. But now it's well known enough that I think victims are feeling more comfortable.
Good.
So oftentimes we'll talk to someone, and then they'll have a friend who also fell for it. So we're starting to get tips, certainly from a larger universe of people. And I'm really hoping, I every day I'm like, are we going to get the voicemail from, I know who it is,
you know, right?
or like, I think it's my sister.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to have like another clearing parallel where somebody knows and they're afraid to come forward, but they do. Oh my gosh. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in audio, especially, because filmed entertainment is too expensive. You kind of can't do this ongoing investigation element, because by the time somebody commits $1 million to your documentary, they want to know what the ending is.
Sure.
And I think the danger in podcasts is that you have too many shows that, and this, you know, I don't mean to criticize Serial because I think it was a great show, but when you got to the end, we don't know if did Adnan do it or not. We still don't know. And I think there's an audience in podcasting that's willing to tolerate that. So it's fun. It's fun to make a show not knowing where the end is, but I think it's a lot better if you can get to the end and be able to deliver an answer to people. And I think, you know, we didn't know where In the Dark was going to go, even though it was pretty certain that he was innocent. And now, of course, he's been vindicated. And
yeah.
And then there are plenty of stories, including The Clear. I mean, you know, I'll be the first to say, like, it's not like we got to the end of The Clearing and we were like, okay, these are the 7 murders that Edwards did. And these 500 he definitely didn't do. I think we disproved a few. We suggested what was possible. But to some extent, it's impossible. And I think that's why on The Clearing we wanted to end with victims, because what we didn't want to do is get to the end and be like, oh, we're frustrated because we didn't actually solve the murder.
It was yeah.
And with this show, I'm pretty confident there will be a satisfying ending.
Oh my gosh, it's too good. I'm so excited. Okay, well, we'll make sure that we link to the show and maybe we'll pop your trailer into this episode so people can hear it if they haven't already started. And if you'll allow me, I when I was researching you, I came across your super long form article on Elisa Lam. And this isn't very recent. I know you wrote this several years ago. But, you know, that's a case that is definitely one of my, you know, I can get sucked down that rabbit hole still, and as can many. And your article really touched on the multiple facets that have made that story just continue to dominate Reddit and conspiracy theorists and true crime fans. So could you talk about why and how you started writing about Elisa Lam?
Yeah, that's similar in a way to the Edwards story, and that I was like aware of the phenomenon before I was aware of the details of the crime. I think I saw the elevator video there. So that case hinges on a very famous and creepy elevator video. So this this woman who went missing in an LA hotel, ultimately found dead. The last known footage of her is this really creepy footage in the elevator, and that went viral. And I remember, and I couldn't tell you exactly when or where I saw it, but I remember seeing that and it just sort of lodged in my mind. And then I was like kind of following it, watching it become this phenomenon. And again, in the way that Edwards kind of became a meme, she sort of became this like suspicious death meme, but I realized that no one had actually told the story. It was just sort of like, oh my God, creepy haunted hotel murderer probably in that video. And then I started looking into it, and I found that there was like just the universe of conspiracy theories about what happened to her. Everything that you could possibly imagine, including supernatural and government mind control. And like, she had literally become a meme, and there was like millions of YouTube videos. So I just sat down and like decided to try and figure out what the true story was, and spent like months actually learning what was true and what wasn't. Similar to, again, the Edwards story. It was like, okay, let's just use objective facts and reporting and trying to figure out what happened to her. But again, like, you know, keep referencing The Clearing, but I also felt like the way that story ends was like, I felt like I had done the right thing and that I had handled it responsibly, but I still got to the end and felt really kind of uncomfortable and gross. Cause I was just like, what am I even doing here? Like, I'm just like, I felt like I was doing the right, I'm like trying to tell the true story, but I was like, but this is like a woman who died in, you know, 21 and in a hotel thousands of miles away from her family. And I just want to like acknowledge for like the last quarter of the story of who this person was, and like let's grapple with the idea of why are we doing this, you know, like is there a reason at the end? And I was like, I would love to. And I what I found with her is that I was feeling really gross about the conspiracy theories. I was getting really annoyed with people for treating her death like entertainment. And then I started going into like, she'd led a very public social media life. And I started finding, amidst all the terrible comments, some really poignant and touching stuff in the comments under her posts long after she had died. So people were still going there and writing like these really heartbreaking things about like understanding her psychological issues and the pain that she was going through, and also just feeling really sad that this life had been snuffed out. And the, you know, the terrible thing about her is that like, it wasn't a murder. It was a accidental death that we'll probably never, it just doesn't make sense. Like, let's be honest, like she drowned in a water tank on top of a roof. And I could probably stand in an auditorium and argue with people for like months, and I will never convince some people that that's what happened, because they just will say, they'll say to me, how could that happen? Why would you possibly climb up on a roof and get into a water tank and drown? I'm like, well, you have to understand that it seemed like she was having some kind of psychotic break. She was taking medicine that she'd stopped taking. It's clear from her behavior that something was, like, there was some kind of disconnect happening. She seemed like she was probably running from someone. Maybe she was hiding, and she fell into a circumstance that she couldn't get herself out of. And it's terrible. And, you know, to me, it's, you know, there's no happy ending to that story, but it's like a slightly better outcome. I mean, and I don't, the family maybe disagree with me about here, but like, accident to me is better than murder, because murder means that someone willingly took another human life. And that, you know, like an accident, it doesn't make the pain any less, but I feel like it's less terrible in some way, you know, because it wasn't someone who killed someone intentionally. And I think that case is one, you know, 100 years from now, we'll probably be debating whether the true story is that it was an accident. I honestly believe it was. And actually I'm involved in a there's a docuseries being made about that, that will be on Netflix in, I think February. So Imagine Entertainment. Wow. Joe Berlinger is a great true crime director. He made a 4-part series that I helped produce. So that, I've seen parts of it. It looks really good. And it's going to delve into the case. And also the case of the Cecil Hotel, which is just, also become a mythic location, a haunted hotel.
Well, yeah, and a character in that story, and in many stories. I would love an introduction to Joe Berlinger to interview him when that comes out. He's wonderful, and I'm definitely going to want to watch that. No, I really appreciated you painting a holistic picture of her, of the context around her trip, the hotel itself, the community that ended up being part of all the conspiracies and information, and then, you know, who she was and after death. So it's a beautiful read, and I will probably put that in the show notes too, because I think it's a really, if you care about that case, I think you should read this, or if you're interested in that case.
It's, you know, I've written a lot of stories in my life. That one really resonated. I got probably more mail about that than anything else.
Yeah.
All kinds of mail. People who like think I'm, you know, how you're wrong, but a lot of it was just like, thanks for actually spending the time. And I think that's the, you know, when with all of these projects, they just take a lot of time. If you want to report something responsibly, and I think that's why these shows are, people often say, oh, they're complicated and expensive. They are, because they just take a lot of time. And like, I spent months on that story. Just because I think, you know, these are all very sensitive subjects, and you can't possibly do justice to them quickly, at least if you want to feel good about yourself in the morning.
I love that. I love that philosophy to drive your work, and you're doing great stuff. And so you mentioned this Netflix doc. Do you have anything else in the work? How about a next podcast for Campsite?
My next podcast is also a true crime story, actually.
Oh, well, fantastic. Right place.
It's based on a story I wrote for Business Week about a Boeing engineer who became addicted to OxyContin and then like slowly spiraled into a heroin addiction and then became one of the most successful bank robbers of recent memory. And I wrote that 2 years ago for Business Week. And so I've been spending more time with him. Well, during the pandemic, we talk on the phone a lot. He's now he got arrested. I mean, I'm not giving anything away, because my story starts with his arrest. And I think podcast will also, he's now out of prison. So it's a story about bank robbery, but it's more a story about the opiate crisis in America. So hopefully, I think, that story got a lot of mail too. And the thing about that one is that people said, I never really understood the opioid story until I read this, because you're like, oh, it's a fun bank robbery story. But actually you learn how a life falls apart and how like a quote unquote normal person, which we mean like someone who was successful and had a good life, like just loses everything because of an addiction. And so it's called Hooked. I haven't started working on it yet, except that I've done tons of interviews. So we're hopefully next summer, probably.
Okay. That is an area I think there's a gross lack of understanding. So I'm excited for that. I have a question that I just can't stop myself from asking, and you can decline. But did he ever fly high? Like fly up?
No, No, he was an engineer, not a pilot. So he designed.
Oh, okay. I just, yeah. when you, I have a deep, real fear of flying, and I needed to know that because basically it would just mean I'd take a train and a drive everywhere. Oh my God.
So he probably did fly high, but he wasn't flying the plane. So it's okay.
Okay. That's fair. Fine with that. Totally fine. Oh,
and I should also say I would be doing my company a disservice if I didn't say we have MapShare, so the creator of Over My Dead Body, he and Eric Benson, who they co-created that show, they have a show in the process for us called Suspect, which is it's a wrongful conviction story about a murder up in Seattle that hinged on some very shady DNA evidence. So that we haven't formally announced it yet, but that should be coming soon. That will appear in a very exciting place that I can't say yet, but it's called Suspect. And I heard the first episode. It's great. It's a real, you know, like deep dive into a crime that the wrong person was. He's now again, all out of jail, but he spent 9 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And it talks a lot about how that happens and how, you know, quote unquote science, like DNA, we don't really understand it. And often we trust people who sit on a witness chair and tell us that they're, you know, this is true. It's not always true. So
you're hitting, I sure will be. I just did a 2-part interview with an exoneree. So he served 16 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. The Innocence Project helped overturn his conviction. It's staggering how often it happens. Again, I think this is something that we're starting to see more of in the true crime genre. On more podcasts, I interviewed David Rudolph, who now works solely on wrongful convictions, Michael Peterson's defense attorney, which is super cool to hear. Maggie Freeling, an investigative journalist, I interviewed her. She's doing a podcast dedicated to those people's stories. So love that movement. I love that change in awareness. I think it's hard to hear those stories, but it's really important. Okay, I'm gonna let you go, but first I have to ask you what I ask all my guests at the end of our dialogue. Okay. Is what is keeping you up at night?
Whether or not my kids are going to school and when they're going to school.
Yeah, I hear that.
Also solving chameleon, you know, like finding the culprit in chameleon. I would say there's two things, actually three things. So it's solving chameleon.
Okay.
My kids and school and the damn Hamilton soundtrack, which my kids are obsessed with and is just like stuck in my head, like the deepest of earworms. So I wake up at like 3 a.m. just like singing Alexander Hamilton songs.
Oh, that's not a bad place to live though. I mean, considering everything that could be going into your head, we went through that Hamilton soundtrack phase a couple years ago in our household with the kids too. I hear you on all of that. Have they gotten to see it?
Well, they watched the Disney Plus version, yeah, okay. Which is not the same, but yes, yeah. But yeah, great music, but I mean, like, I've never had I thought Frozen soundtrack was bad, but this one is earwormed like so deeply into my brain.
Yeah, there's a lot of TikTok videos about that, just people who like spew it out when they're asked a regular question. They just recite Hamilton lyrics because it's so ingrained in their bones at this point. Josh, it was such a pleasure meeting you. Keep up the amazing work, and thank you so much for killing the small talk with me.
Of course, thank you. This was fun.
Yeah, this was great. Thank you.
Thanks for killing the small talk. Dialogue is a Yellow Tape Media production, edited by Jason Usri and produced and hosted by me, Rebecca Sebastian. Please be sure to subscribe to Dialogue, a true crime conversation, wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow us on social media. We are at Dialogue Pod across all platforms. You can also drop me a note or a guest suggestion or sign up for my newsletter at RebeccaSebastian.com. Be sure to join me every Wednesday for a new episode and another killer conversation.